Welcome to Mr. Speaker Spotlight, the place to be recognized. This is the June 2000 edition of the Spotlight, and this spotlight shines on Dr. Kenneth S. Armstrong. As president of the United Way of the Big Bend, Dr. Armstrong is helping that organization become a catalyst for a stronger, healthier community. Ken came to Tallahassee in 1996 from Texas, where he led the major gift development program of the United Way of Metropolitan Dallas. In this position, he worked with such national figures as Bill Gates, Carol Burnett, Carolyn Hunt, and Roger Staubach. His appointment to our United Way culminated a 25-year career in nonprofit management, much of it in college and university administration. And I'm going to stop right there because you can read the rest of that on the webpage. Dr. Armstrong.
Oh, you, don't you dare. Don't you dare start.
All right, Ken, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's an excellent day.
And I just want to say thank you for being featured on the Spotlight, you know, and I'll just share with the listeners, you know, this interview should have taken place at least 2 years ago, and I thank you for being patient and, you know, waiting on me to finally get the time and the right venue to interview you.
Well, I have to say I'm honored to be your first Spotlight person and would like to congratulate you on this mission that is now off. It's T plus one, I guess.
Yes, indeed.
And after a long time of T minus minutes or, and hours and days for this Spotlight to be shining brightly is very exciting, and I'm glad to be here working with you, Vincent.
Oh, thank you. And Ken, you know, this is going to be the opportunity for you to share your story however you want to approach it with the listening audience, because my goal here is to let them know who you are, the man, what makes you. And with that being said, who is Ken Armstrong?
Well, I was laying in bed last night as I was going to sleep and thinking to myself, I'm glad that Vincent didn't give me any questions in advance. And as any person does, I think, trying to figure out, I wonder what he's going to ask. And the question that I think a lot of us use in these words or others when we're trying to get to know somebody is very similar to the question that you just asked. What makes you tick? And the word popped into my mind, the community. It's relatively new to me. As you read, I'm trained in the field of higher education. That's what I expected to be and do and what I did for most of my career. And then almost accidentally, I stumbled into a conversation with the man who turned out to be the president of the United Way in Dallas. And he and I decided that we would work together on a project which turned into a 3-year commitment. And it was through that process that I discovered I love this thing we call community. I love the campus life, love the students and the administrators and faculty and alums and parents and so forth. The campus life is terrific, as many of your viewers, readers, interneters know. But when you add to it the set of constituents that I have the opportunity to work with in the community, and you see how all the pieces connect when they should, or when you see pieces that don't connect and you feel like they ought to in order for the community to be working more holistically and more successfully. I love trying to get those folks to see a sense of common mission around making the community better. And I've fallen in love with the stuff, and it'll take dynamite to blow me out of here.
Wow. When you talk about this whole sense of community, what was your community like growing up as a young man?
I didn't have one. I am a preacher's kid. I lived in probably 12 states by the time I was ready to go away to college. And so my community changed every year or so. And I have no roots as a consequence. But it, along with the adaptability, comes a sense of, I think, relatively soon, being able to figure out how things work and who in your new high school or who in your new middle school or whatever is a good person to connect with and where the danger signals are. And so I think probably the adaptability or the flexibility or the perceptiveness that came with moving a lot prepared me for this. This is the longest I've ever lived anywhere in my life. This 13 years is wow. by far the longest I've ever lived anywhere.
So change is something you're truly accustomed to.
Indeed.
Wow. I didn't know you were a PK.
Oh, yes. And a PKK.
A PKK?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So does that mean you're going to eventually move into the ministry?
I never say never, obviously. But it's, I think, a real tribute to both my father and my grandfather. By the time you get to a third generation, I think there's a, sort of a lot of pent-up pressure, whether it's internal or closely external or sort of out there in the world, an expectation. My father and my grandfather didn't do that. And growing up, Vincent, and this is something else you don't know, I thought I was going to be the next Perry Mason. In my generation, if you were interested in practicing law, which I thought I was, that meant that you aspired to be Perry Mason. And within a week of law school, I realized that that wasn't likely the way things were going to end up. And then I began to take stock about courtroom criminal law and the compromises that I think in a lot of cases it requires a person to make. And so my love shifted very rapidly to higher education, a small Christian liberal arts education, and that's what I have worked in most of my life until I stumbled into United Way. So while from time to time I feel like I'm a missionary, a pastor, a counselor, a lot of times, obviously, I can't say cajoler, an exhorter. No, I don't expect to find myself as a clergyman.
No. Well, when you look at your life, all of the relationships that you were able to make, the associations from, you know, moving around a lot, who can you say or whom influenced you? In a positive light is where I'm going with
understand.
That.
Understand. I think work ethic is something that we either get or don't get. And I don't know whether in all the things we read and hear about this generation or that generation or the other generation, I don't know whether one necessarily has a better work ethic than another. But my dad and my granddad and my mom, from an academic perspective, really sold me on the idea of work. And as a 9 or 10 year old, I was hauling cement blocks from the pallet over there, you know, down to the house, and hauling concrete and picking up nails and everything. So I think the work ethic that was instilled in me by my family has always been something that I've appreciated. I guess a second thing that I probably also attribute primarily to my dad is he never believed in boundaries. Think like there were no boundaries. Think like there was no expected way to do something.
So it was always outside of the box type thinking, as they would say today.
Instead of two options, find four options. Find six options. Find ways that even you may reject 30 seconds after you find it, but find options. And that, whether you're working on building a program or finding a way to do some resource development work, which is obviously a lot of what I do, or how to put people together, as we talked about earlier, the idea of looking at that issue, that opportunity, in as many ways as you can before you start narrowing down. My dad used to say, don't kill the baby. And I think that's really wonderful advice. When an idea is this big, it can be killed like that. And he never would let me kill an idea when it was fresh. He wanted it to get life and lungs and be given the best opportunity to present itself and to survive before you started trying to figure out whether it was the right thing to do.
Wow, that whole concept of almost nurturing, giving it that opportunity to grow. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. But you've done all that you can do. From an educational standpoint, what made you pursue the entire track to become a doctor?
It was pretty easy at first. I felt like I needed the business administration piece of this, because back when I was pursuing this, college, particularly college presidents, university presidents have always managed such a complex set of interactions and constituencies and so forth that I think business management, business administration has been important to them for a long time. But small private liberal arts college presidents probably weren't in those days as conscious of the business administration aspects of what they needed to do and the marketing aspects. So it was a pretty easy decision to go after my MBA, and the MED just seemed like the logical thing to do. And then, to be totally honest with you, Vincent, it became a credential. I can't tell you that a lot, I probably can't tell you that anything that I learned through the coursework of the PhD program is something that I use now, or maybe would even have used were I sitting in a college president's chair somewhere today instead. But in order to be a college president, you had to be Dr. President. And so I went and did it and had a wonderful experience at University of Virginia. I fell in love with Virginia and the Piedmont of Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia. So that in itself, seeing that part of God's creation, was wonderful, and great relationships and friendships, and no regrets whatsoever.
What defines you in your downtime or off time? Basically, what do you like to do? Fish, golf, I mean, relaxing and getting away from it all. If you could just have a day to do nothing, where would I find Ken?
It would probably depend on how pent up I was. There would be three or four different things depending on my state of normal mind. If I'd felt confined and pressed down and frustrated or whatever in the days that led up to that, then you'd probably find me out pounding nails or mixing concrete or some very physical activity. That
back to the days of your youth.
Yeah. Absolutely. That is a complete mental relief from the normal work day, and also something that I could see progress on 4 hours after I started it, because a lot, I mean, you live in a similar world. Very frequently, you don't see a lot of progress and on whatever it is you're working on. But if I decide that I'm going to build the this or pour the that or repair this, 4 hours later, I can see, well, that wasn't there before, and now it's there. And that sense of sort of immediate accomplishment is terrific. I love to go to the lake and sit there and look at the water, whether it's the lake or the beach. I love to just sit and enjoy the water. If I'm going to be with somebody, a round of golf is very relaxing for me. I'm terrible at it. I shoot 106. Doesn't matter. I shoot 106. Every day I shoot 106. And I play 3 or 4 times a year. But the fact that I'm so bad at it means that I don't get frustrated with myself very often. I'm there for a good time. I'm there for a walk in the park, so to speak. And so 2 or 3 places I would be, depending on just what led up to it. Wow.
And we often say that hindsight is 20/20. And when you look at the man that you've become over all of your life's experiences, and you were sitting down and you were talking to a group of elementary students or middle school or even high school kids, We all have those 1 or 2 things that, wow, I would probably do it a little bit different, and not necessarily different, or I wish I would have had more information about that. If there were 3 things that you could take the time to say to a group of young people, what would those 3 things be?
Now I wish I'd asked you for the list of questions. One of them is, I think, an anonymous saying. I have never seen it attributed to anybody. I saw it in a magazine when I was probably in my 30s, and I don't know that I would have appreciated it as much before then, because as a kid, I was real focused and real driven academically, to the point where I honestly thought my parents were way too hard on me. So I was a very serious young man, and probably nerdy. I think it would be safe to say. Okay, good deal.
I can relate.
Well, then, and knowing you a little bit as I do now, I think you'll get this statement too. It's a very simple 6 or 7 word statement in a magazine that I immediately tore out and have carried with me and in all of my moves. It is not ourselves, but our responsibilities we should take seriously. And I just love that. I think that part of my message would be, don't take yourself too seriously. You just aren't that big a cog. You're just not going to cause the world to come crashing down. And most certainly, you should plan to enjoy your life. Our responsibilities, those we have to take seriously. But if we take ourselves too seriously, I think we just set ourselves up. I think we make it harder for people around us. We don't have variety in our lives. We just don't relax enough. So, you know, I do skits and I do crazy things. I just don't take myself very seriously. And so that's one thing that I would exhort people to do, whether they're little or big, is not to take ourselves too seriously. A second thing is probably the same thing that I mentioned earlier. Try to find options. Try to look at life. Try to look at the issue, the topic, in unconventional ways. Try to figure out ways around around an obstacle, over, under, through, and a third one leapt into my mind there as I was talking about that, and now it's left me for a moment. I know at some point you want to talk about the book, and I'll I'll tell you there's one little section in the book where Patrick Fox is confronted with a swollen torrent that he has to reach the other side of. And in his mind, in the book, obviously, he does the, is there a way over this, or is there a way around it? And he asks himself the questions over, under, around, or through, and ends up dealing with it in a particular way. But that's an encouragement I would give to people, is to look at things from a whole different perspective if they can come up.
And now I'm getting a little bit more insight after talking to you, because one of the questions I was going to ask you, are you the president or are you the pro in the book? And I kind of get a sense of now who I think you are in the book.
Patrick clearly has some perspectives that I would have. No, I'm certainly not the pro, and I certainly don't aspire to the adventurous life that Patrick Fox has by a long shot. The third one still hasn't re-entered my mind, but will. So go ahead, and it's a conversation. I'll say, like normal in life. Oh, I remember.
Yeah. Bring it back, because I mean, this is just, you know, I really, really admire you, and I know I've told you that many a times, and so
I know what it was.
Okay, well,
I got it. Travel.
Oh yeah,
when I was 16, I guess, my dad was principal for a while of a they call them principals in Africa. It's the equivalent of a president. But he was the principal of a college in Johannesburg, South Africa, for a year. And so my family got to go down for a good portion of that time. And I got to come back through Europe and one thing and another. And every opportunity that a person has when they're young in life to experience other cultures, they ought to just jump at. If there's a high school exchange program, they ought to apply for it. If there's a college year abroad program, they ought to do it. If a couple of their friends are thinking about going and backpacking through Canada, they ought to do it. The earlier in life somebody can travel, go somewhere else, deal with the hassle and the inconvenience of the travel experience, and deal with the interactions with other people and other places, they ought to jump on it.
What did that do for you?
I think we're, U.S.-centric, Americentric. we believe that our culture is at the middle of the world, and that everything else sort of is in satellite motion around the United States. And it did for me then, and I think does for most everybody who travels, just change the world from Copernicus, from somebody to, who was it? From Ptolemy to Copernicus.
Okay. But Ptolemy.
It lets them know that the world doesn't revolve around us, that we're all in rotation around each other in some very complex and vague system that I think eventually gets you to the place that God knew what he was doing when he created all sorts of folks.
Yes, indeed. And it opens up an individual's eyes. I mean, with me being prior military and going overseas and being in Korea, being in Saudi Arabia, you get a different perspective, and you learn that, hey, like you said, this way is not the only way. When you're looking at options and trying to figure out, it broadens your horizons.
So that was the third thing.
That was the third.
Sorry I interrupted.
No, that is perfectly fine. Here's a tough question. It's tough. So I'm
okay. So I get 15 minutes to think about this one. Pardon the dead air here for 15 minutes.
You know, if you were walking out of your home and it was told to you that, you know, you can't look back and all you can take is just three things with you. I mean, you can get another home. I mean, but out of your surroundings, what you have at your place of residence now, you're going to walk out the door and there are only three things that you can take with you. What would those three things be?
Well, difficult question and surprising answer, I think. I'm assuming that the things that I could take with me aren't people.
They can be people. And family could be one of the items. I mean, if you say my family, it can include everybody in the house, including pets.
Okay. Well, now
you're really putting me on the spot.
including pets. So, you know, that.
Well, that
where I'm going with this, because, I mean, when you really have to narrow things down, it's like, what's important? What's important to us as an individual?
Well, I won't take the easy way out. I'm obviously the easy way out is to say family, but I'll go with my initial gut instinct, which was to deal with a difficult and complex question in maybe a surprising way, and I guess my answer would be that I wouldn't need to take anything with me. If somebody told me just what you said, you have to walk away, you have to start fresh. I think probably, clearly, my wife will kill me if I don't.
I'll give you the leeway. Okay. You know what I'm saying. I know where you're going with it, and it's a very interesting approach to it.
If I haven't, by my age, figured out that my motivations, my interests, my values, and so forth aren't suitable for me, and that I've culled out ones that aren't right or haven't worked or whatever, and replaced them with values and motivations and talents and commitments and so forth that do, then, you know, I've wasted a whole lot of time. So I obviously where I'm going is I have enough. I have enough in me now that you could plop me down anywhere. Therewith to be content, and I could be a bricklayer's assistant somewhere, or I could I could shovel coal on a tanker bound from Tunisia to Patagonia. I don't need any of the things I've acquired. I don't need. I'll just stop there.
And that's powerful because I really feel that coming from you. It's the sense of that things don't define who you are.
Absolutely.
It's what God has placed inside of me. I could lose everything, but that sense of value, that sense of a relationship, and knowing who I am, I can start again.
Oh, absolutely. It is, I think God instills in us a sense of self, which we fight against, accept, mold, reject sometimes, and it's a very zigzaggy road as we try to discover what that sense of self should be or can become or whatever. And I'm old enough that I have gotten to the place where, as you say, things don't define me. People know, I think, who Ken is, and I'm not right for everybody by a long shot, but I'm pretty much, to go back to the scripture, you know, where I am, I'm content.
Content. I know how to be abased and abound, but I'm content. You have two words on your shirt, and they're live united. What is it for? What does it mean?
Oh, that's a good thing it's a long program. I'll give you the condensed version. I obviously work for United Way of the Big Bend, which covers an 8-county area surrounding the capital city of Florida. And everywhere anybody has lived, there's been a United Way of something. And the natural tendency is to think that this is all one big national or international thing with local chapters. Well, United Ways chose not to organize themselves that way. Every single United Way of the 1,281, I think, of us that there are, is completely independent. It's its own 501c3 organization. It has its own governing board. It is not managed by some headquarters somewhere. Wow. It is headquarters. And consequently, you have 1,281 different ways that United Ways like to describe themselves, because they reflect the values and geography and so forth of wherever it is they are. The United Way in Spokane, Washington is very different than our United Way. The United Way of Tuscaloosa, Alabama is very different from the United Way of Boston, Massachusetts. And so there is sort of very little common thread between us, and the huge international advertising and marketing firm McCann Erickson.
Okay.
Was engaged by us to see if they could come up with a phrase that virtually every United Way could say, that's what we do, that's us, and that 1,281 different slogans and different themes and different mottos and so forth might kind of be able to be all put under this umbrella. And McCann Erickson, to their huge credit, said, well, what all 1,281 of you United Ways do is try to get people to give, advocate, volunteer, live united. And so that's the shirt I'm wearing today, is that magical identity. It's not a theme. It's not a slogan. It's an identity. It's a description of what United Ways try to do in their 12 or 1300 different communities, which is to get people to see the way in which they are more alike than they are different. We in American society, maybe human society, I don't know, spend most of our life defining our differences. You dress like that, I dress like this. You live there, I live here. You went to school there, I went to school here. You, me, and it's the distinctions.
I'm trying to move towards the we.
Exactly. So I love the fact that one time a year, for one purpose, we put aside where we work or whether we do the gator chomp or the tomahawk chop. We put aside those things and we say, for this cause, for this community, we will live united.
Wow. So I'm going to, what I feel, put you in your comfort zone. Talk to us about the United Way of the Big Bend. You know, give us, you know, if you were, and you've done this many a times, and I know you get your opportunity to do your 2-minute spiel, your 5-minute spiel, you have the news clips. But right here and right now, for someone who was clueless about the United Way of the Big Bend, what would you say to them?
Well, I came here 13 years ago to a United Way whose board told me in the recruitment process that they felt like the United Way had the opportunity to do more, be more. And it was in a period of time when the United Way of the Big Bend was, I think, doing an adequate job of raising funds, which is what people typically connect with United Way. Oh, yes, they have a bunch of agencies that they support. They raise money in workplaces predominantly, and then they accumulate the money, and in an accountable fashion, using volunteers, they determine where among these agencies and the programs the dollars can be used most productively and effectively to help people across the community. And that's an accurate picture of what the United Way was then, and to some extent an accurate picture of what it is now. But it leaves out now, and the reason I accepted the opportunity to come here as the president of this United Way was that I felt that the board and this community was ready for the strategy mm-hmm. of community. Yes, we could. We could do this campaign, and my shirt here could say Give United. Mm-hmm. And we could raise a little more money, earn a little more money, and a little more money. But at the end of the day, the issues that we face in our lives, whether they're in our communities or in our homes or in our workplaces or in our churches or wherever, have gotten so complex that I am convinced that no one person, no one group of people can solve them. Mm. They're Bill Law, who some folks will recognize as the president of Tallahassee Community College here in Tallahassee, has a saying, all the easy stuff is done, there's only hard stuff left. And I think that's true. All of the issues or obstacles or difficulties in our lives that were easy, they've already been solved. We're only left with hard stuff out there. And consequently, I believe that that it takes coalitions to really solve stuff. So I don't think any longer you can throw money at an issue. Maybe you... polio. Mm-hmm. Okay, we pour enough money into getting rid of polio. We buy enough vaccine. We inoculate enough kids, and we don't have polio in the United States anymore. But we don't have those things anymore. Now we have teenage pregnancy. Not that we didn't always have it, but I mean, we got rid of the easy one, if you will. So now, how do you deal with the young woman who feels 9 different forces working on her and has parents, grandparents, family members, peers, all of whom are seeing the world in different ways, and she throws up her hands and says, you know, I don't know what to do. Well, we have to help her, and we have to, as we deal with people who make bad financial decisions, parents who are dealing with aging grandparents and teenagers simultaneously, we can name problem after problem after problem, where the complexity of it is so astounding. I think about a huge section of our populace who feels that the system is truly stacked against them, that there is nobody on their side, that the pawn shop owner, the predatory income tax preparer, the check cashing place down on the corner, the credit counseling group that they see every time they turn on TV that says, oh, so your credit's shot, call us at 1-800, we'll save you. they know that all these people exist only for the purpose of taking advantage of them, that there are complete industries who make their living on taking advantage, on preying on these folks. So no one group, the Consumer Credit Counseling Service, which is one of our agencies, God bless them, they can't, they're not big enough, they're not powerful enough, they don't have a large enough voice to solve those issues. But if we get employers, pastors, government leaders, high school principals, neighborhood association presidents, I mean, why would we, in our neighborhoods, we have these signs up everywhere that say neighborhood watch, right. Crime watch.
Crime watch, yes. One in my neighborhood.
There we go. Why should we not have signs up that say kid watch, where the block captain goes and visits every mom who is newly pregnant and says, wow, you are going to have a lot on you for the next 8 or 9 months and then the first couple or 3 years of your child's life. What are you going to need? What are you going to need? Do you have... have you made a decision about whether you're going to breastfeed or not? Do you have health insurance for your kids? Is your pastor or somebody in your church home working with you about the changes this is going to bring about in your life? How's this going to affect your job, your transportation? Why don't we have a kid watch in neighborhoods? So you didn't expect the answer was going to be this long.
Well, the thing I love
about United Way is the capacity to look at complex problems and try to figure out how to bring the judicial system, the law enforcement system, the Chamber of Commerce, the Tallahassee newspaper and media and so forth, all into some sort of collective understanding and collective mission around doing things better.
Wow. And that's, it goes back to the two words on your shirt, living united. But I sense this strong sense of connectivity there and bringing everybody together, because just throwing money at something is not going to help. We need ideas. We need creative ways not only to mitigate, but to prevent these things from ever occurring again.
When you and I were kids, Vincent's obviously about 40 years younger than I am, but even when you were a child, nobody ever heard the word infrastructure. Now it's one of our buzzwords. Obviously. But for this purpose, it's an accurate description. We have to change the infrastructure of the way our communities operate, and there's a fellow in town that works with me on an early childhood effort that's called Whole Child in our community. He's an architect, and he's been on this steering committee for it. His name's Lori Dozier. He won't mind me mentioning it. He's been on the steering committee to deal with this way we approach children from 0 to 5 and their families. So after he'd been doing this for a couple of years, we were sitting in a meeting together, and he said, guys, I used to, when I was sitting in a restaurant, I used to be determining, are those 8-foot ceilings or are those 8-foot 6 ceilings? And boy, they didn't do a very good job of hanging that door. Or, if the hardware were a little bit better on those windows, they'd have fewer break-ins and so forth. And he said, now I'm sitting in the same restaurant and I'm thinking to myself, boy, how does that mother with those 2 little kids deal with the pressures that are on her every day? And I'm thinking, hallelujah.
Yeah.
I mean, for this businessman to be thinking about this mom and her 2 little kids and what he and we can be doing differently in order to make life better for her and not to stack the system against her. That's part of Live United, I think.
Wow, that's powerful. And I mean, time is just going away, and I'm enjoying this. We're going to get to the author. the author can. You know, and you know, I won't stay on that long, and we'll find out how we can go ahead and get a copy of the book. But I started reading it, and I mean, when I started reading it, I mean, you set me up in the beginning because I thought something was, you know, I was like, oh, I, you know, but Saving the President, what prompted that title?
What's it's the craziest story and completely nonsensical. I had some major thing going on. I don't remember what it was that occupied me for a week. And so I was a complete vegetable one afternoon. I can't remember, Saturday or Sunday afternoon. And I sat on the couch and I watched back to back two episodes of a movie called Sniper. Tom Berenger, I think, is the star of the movie. And it's a Vietnam era, I think, movie about a military sniper. And I watched it, and that was the end of that, and I turned it off and so forth. And I woke up the next morning with an idea that wouldn't it be cool if the president of the United States had a super secret defender who was obviously a sniper and who was the president's last line of defense.
And that's why you set me up in the beginning of the book. Yeah,
of course, of course. And and so I said to Jeannie, you know, wouldn't it be cool if the president had, and the Secret Service doesn't know about him, and so he befriends the president and the things that he has to do and how he operates and one thing and another. And she said, well, that really is an interesting idea. And so a day or so later, I said, you know, what if the idea originated with Hitler? What if Hitler was the first world leader to have one of these, because Hitler was obviously paranoid about being assassinated, and wouldn't that be an interesting twist? And Jeannie said, yeah, it would be an interesting twist. And then I think it was the next day she said to me, you know, what if there was some kind of a deal that connected to the Kennedy assassination, because you'd assume that Kennedy might have had a protector like this, and something went wrong. And I said, well, yeah, that would be interesting. And so within the matter of a week, I had decided I've never wanted to write a book. I've never aspired to it. I've never had an interest. I've never taken a writing course in my life. But this idea just begged to be put down on paper. And so I started writing like a fiend.
Yeah, because it kind of like a little cross between Vantage Point. I was like, I started reading that. I saw that movie. I said, whoa, a little bit of that. A little bit of 24 with the titles going on and the dates. I was like, all he needs now is this occurs between one and.
Yes. It's funny that you say that, because I have recently really gotten interested in 24.
And then, you know, a little bit of like almost the James Bond, and from the aspect of he has a girl. And so
although that was one challenging thing for me, because I can't write a sexy four-letter filled.
No, I mean, not gory, that's what he had. The association.
Oh,
there.
Sure. Oh, yeah, no, there has to be a little romance.
The romance. That's what I'm going at. But I know it's not.
Clearly, there has to be some romance. But it was. It was not. It wasn't part of my original design. But as I found myself writing through it, I kept asking myself, "Is this going to be believable? Is it going to be saleable?" because there's no sex in it, and because nobody ever says an F word or a D word or whatever.
But I found that good.
Well, that's, I hope so. I hope so.
Yeah. So, wow, it's powerful. So where can the listeners get a copy of
The simplest thing to do is to tell them to go to my website, probably, which is kenarmstrongbooks.com. KenArmstrongBooks.com. I've been flirting with a publisher, and flirting with an agent, and one thing and another. And so I'm still trying to figure out the best way to get it on the shelves, so to speak. You saw the sort of the proof copy, if you will. And so I don't know whether I'm going to put it on the shelves myself as a self-publisher, or whether I'm going to get it out there another way. But anybody who comes to KenArmstrongBooks.com or wants to just go straight to the book's website, which is SavingThePresident.com, I'll communicate with them, and we'll figure out a way if they're interested.
So do I see movie? Right. two.
Well, I didn't expect so, but I found myself about two thirds of the way into the thing realizing, you know, I'm writing this a lot. I'm completely inexperienced. I promise you, Vincent, I didn't write short stories. I
hated literature when I was in school.
New to me. But I found myself partway through it realizing that I was writing this the way a movie would mm-hmm. work. And I actually had to go back and change some stuff in order to make it more like a book. But, oh, sure, I think it'd make a great movie. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, you're not angling for a part, are you?
No. Maybe just a little voiceover. A little voiceover.
I like it.
This happens on this day. You know? And I know we're going to try to wrap this up. It's so fun and so interesting to be here. I want to talk about what's the Downtown Get Downs? What are they all about? And then I'd like for you to just share a little bit about the upcoming campaign.
Okay, sure. Well, one of the things that that I think sort of developed out of this set of questions and conversations that naturally you'd have anytime you change from one president to another and one sort of perspective, which is fundraising only, to community building, which also was one of those conversations that was happening 12 or 13 years ago. One of them, as you'd expect, revolved around how do we do a better job exposing people to United Way. And the opportunity of this downtown block party sort of presented itself to us. I'd love to be able to say I came up with the idea. I didn't. It was a collection of folks who reached out to United Way, and before we knew it, we were the producer and presenter and so forth of this 2-block-long thing that takes place 9 or 10 times a year right downtown. And it is the cross-section of the community. We'll have lobbyists who earn in the high 6 figures probably doing ID checks. We'll have single moms who it's the only place they can afford to take their kids on a Friday night for some fun and get face painting and the bounce house and so forth, all of which, of course, is free. We just think that it is the best description of who our community is. Great family time. A lot of young professionals love this. It's not as much a college student kind of a thing because we close up at 10 and, you know, yeah, college students.
They're waking up to go out at 10.
But we have a bunch of state employees who come and people just pour into downtown from all over the community. A lot of football fans during the downtown get downs that are a part of football season. But we also do one in connection with springtime Tallahassee. There will be one on July the 3rd. It'll be the first time that we've done a Capital City Bank downtown get down in connection with Independence Day. So we just love the event. I love it. It's just there's music on both ends. There are kids up on the stage dancing.
My son loves that.
There we go. Absolutely.
The on stage party. He's always up there. His eyes are always up there.
Absolutely. When people are picking their kids up at school, we'll hear 2 little ones making their last plan on Friday afternoon. One of the kids will be reported by a parent as having said to his or her little friend, "Okay, now we'll meet you right in front of the community stage at 7:30. Don't be late because that's where we'll be, and we'll meet your family there 7:30, right?" And this is all about the downtown get down.
Downtown get down. Wow.
This campaign is going to be fun. We're doing some things very different. Ordinarily, we have a campaign chair mm-hmm. who is a community leader who chairs the effort for the 3 or 4 or 5 months that it takes place. This year, with so much uncertainty about the economy, will there be a light at the end of the tunnel by September when we kick this off? Will there still be a lot of economic uncertainty? Will people still be losing their jobs? Will people still be having their homes foreclosed on? Or will we be on the upswing? Just that uncertainty made us feel like instead of having one person chair this campaign, that we wanted to get a half a dozen or so people working on different pieces of the campaign and really doing it as a team effort. So that's one way in which this campaign that will start, as I said, in 3 or 4 months will be different. We learned a lot from last year, which was when we unveiled Live United. Mm-hmm. And we discovered that people want more of this stuff. They want not just to have the t-shirt that says Live United. They are asking us at our workplace, at my gym, in my Sunday school class, what can we do that acts out Live United? We love the phrase. Yes, we like the public service announcements that are on TV or radio or billboards or wherever. But now we're really more interested in knowing how we live in order to live united. So we'll be rolling out a whole bunch of different activities and opportunities for give, advocate, and volunteer around Live United. It's going to be a great year.
And I look forward to it. We're getting ready to close. Just maybe a few more questions at the most. But here's, you know, I want you here for at least another 13 years.
You and me both, brother. Talk to my board about that.
Okay, I'll talk to them. We'll make sure they get a copy of this.
Yes, indeed.
And when it's all said and done, what do you want to be said about your tenure with United Way of the Big Bend? I mean, you've done all you. What do you want it to be said? You know, who? Somebody said, "Well, that Ken, he was great. He was so just profound in this, proficient in that. He just did so." What do you want to be said?
Well, the first thing, of course, you know that I want to be said is he didn't take himself too seriously.
Correct. and I know that from a personal note. I mean, he talked about the skits and he loves to do the skits. So that's obvious.
Well, I would like for them to say, I can't believe that relatively small community. I think a lot of people who are outside this part of the country figure, gee whiz, it's the capital of the fourth largest state in the union. Tallahassee must be a big place. Well, we're not a big place.
We don't even have an airport.
Yeah, we're not a big place, and we really do not have a lot of business and industry. This is very much a sort of a professional town, obviously very, very oriented toward education with Florida A&M University and FSU and TCC, clearly a governmental presence. But for us now to be raising on the order of $7 million and hopefully in another 13 years, maybe to be in eight figures by that point, I'd like for people to say he really did a good job raising money for people in our community who need it. But you've gotten enough, I think, of the sense of the conversation to know that I'll be thrilled if people say he really connected the dots. He really found ways to get people who saw their job as health and people who saw their job as juvenile justice and people who saw their job as transportation and to see that they had one job in common, and that was to make sure that people felt that they had an opportunity. I'm not a believer in charity. I don't recall ever having described United Way as a charity. We are an organization, clearly, but we're really, if we do this right, we're really a catalyst. We have to make sure that church folks and neighborhood folks and elementary school teachers see one job in common. And of course, the word common and the word community have the same root. And that's what I'd like to have people say, is he connected the dots. And of course, the dots in this case are people.
nothing else to be added. I mean, that's just a powerful statement. And I just want to take the time to say, Ken, I really thank you for all that you do and that you have done for our community. And that's why I wanted you here to recognize you on Mr. Speaker Spotlight, because we need more men and women like you who have a sense of we can't do this by ourselves. We really need to come together to make a difference. And if someone
together is exactly the right word. That's exactly the right word. I mean, great way to sum it up.
And you know, and if someone listening to this conversation can walk away with that, you in my mind or the example, the mentor, the inspiration and the motivation for individuals to say, hey, it can be done.
Well, we have to get better at it every day.
Thank you so very much, Ken,
I enjoyed it.
For taking the time to be here. And I just feel blessed by this conversation. And I thank God that he allowed you to be the first one in the spotlight, because truly the room has, you lit up the room.
I feel the energy. I'm glad you do too. All
right. You've been listening to Mr. Speaker Spotlight. This has been the June edition